There's some fairly, I've tried to prioritise the agenda, so we do things that I hope people will be more interested in to start with. We've notionally got the place till 6 o'clock. I don't imagine most of us will want to stay till six, so you know we'll try and do first things first. I am Rodney Tillotson. I work for Janet CERT, which is the security coordination team for the Janet Network in the UK, which is the academic and research network. This is how it goes. That's just a bald outline. We always do that sort of thing. The timetable is that what I hope to do is to get through very small things in 5 minutes. There are then some priority things, three sorts of presentation or things that we ought to try and come up with some decisions on the choices. And then we move into more routine updates where there'll be somewhat unscheduled, unscripted discussion, well, entirely unscripted discussions, and I have no idea what issues people are going to come up with this time, and it goes through. And if it takes as long as that, well, it might take as long as that. I don't believe it will, actually. That's okay. Okay, well, we've got... So I'm going to start with this stuff. These are the priority items. The first one at the top we've just got to do anyway. There's something about message headers. I promised I would do that, so I can do that. There's an interaction with the database working group. It's not new, but we need to try and do something about it this time. And there's an upgrade to the only document this working group's ever produced, which we ought to talk about as well. And then we go into the other things. So here we are. This meeting is being the audio multicast, so there are some people somewhere listening to us. There may be some people somewhere listening to us. So if you need to talk so that people can hear you, please use a microphone. Apparently not that one. You'll have to walk up to a microphone. If you've got wonderful whizzy things that make a noise, you might politely wish to turn them off or put them under your cushion or something. Is there anybody here who's following the IRC or Jabber session? Thank you. Right, so Marco will deal with that. Here is the attendee list, which I'll start off at this corner, if you'd mind just passing it back and then forward so that everybody's here has written on it. So although the agenda has an AOB item, I'm not going to worry too much about it. If anybody really wants to interrupt about how the agenda is now, then do, but pretty much anything else we want to talk about can fit in later on. Right, I've talked about most of this, haven't I? Agenda, yes, minutes. The minutes of the last working group meeting are in the usual place. You can find them just by applying through the right website. Sabri Berisha would be here, but he can't be this time, so there is a co-chair for this group now, and I might not have had to come. That's right, I like coming, but... it might not always be as easy as that, and I hope Sabri will be here again next time. He sends his apologies. So, I'm going to do my little tutorial now, such as it is. Now, there was no brief for this. We have been saying for ages we ought to do some sort of tutorials. We'd never identified target audiences or anything like that. This is supposed to be really a fairly harmless one. But you should, don't be insulted because it's too easy, and don't be offended if you are here because you actually don't understand anything about this stuff, and I've got it wrong, and you want to ask questions. The people who know it all will kindly be patient for a moment, and will help me out when I don't understand what's going on. So really, it is intended for people who don't know where else to go to find out what you do with message headers. And the guys who already know how to deal with message headers will please join in. That's right. I don't think I can spin it out for 20 minutes, but we'll try. Well, why should you bother? This is just an outline of the things. I'll go through the things. Why should you bother? Now, the reason in this context is that most of the things that people know about spam, about unsolicited bulk email, are visible in message headers. If you're lucky, you can work out what's happened, to some extent who the bad guys are, not entirely, but you can make a start. And one of the interesting things is that although the spammers can forge, everything, you have to start, your starting point is anything that a spammer causes to be in a message is false. It's a lie. And that includes the whole of the message header. We'll come back to that in a minute. But actually, you get some information even from the false bits. And so it's worth ploughing over a fair amount of the stuff. That's why I think we're doing it. Some people are fascinated by all sorts of details in these things, and that's good. People should be fascinated. And it is also true that by doing some very careful examination and analysis, you can get some amazing results. But I'm not into that, so that's fine. Okay. I hope there's nobody who is alarmed at the whole idea of what a message looks like. If I would just say a few words so that people who would be too embarrassed to ask don't have to ask, but if I get it wrong or you want to know more, do say so. RFC 2822, a worthy successor to the ancient 822, which is about 20 odd years old, says that a message, an internet message, is made up of ASCII text, and it has a header part, and then there's a blank line, and then the body. And the message body is what you expect to read on the screen, and which is not very interesting in today's context. It's what the spammers want to deliver to you, but not interested in what they want to deliver to you. We're actually looking at the other bit at the moment. And the header is the rest. The interesting thing about the header is that most ordinary people, none of you are ordinary people or you wouldn't be here, most ordinary people never see the message header, and it's a great mystery to them. Mr. Gates has ensured that most of them will never see the message header because it's not part of his vision for the world, and he hides it with all his products to a limited extent. Anybody wish to question any of that stuff? Right, this, I think, somebody can tell me if I got it wrong. I think this is the smallest legal header you can have. It has two lines. These are actually stated as mandatory. You've got to have two lines. One is a from line, and the other is a date, a timestamp. I have to point out immediately, because this is what's going to come out, that none of this tells you anything about what's going to happen to what has happened to the mail message, or what will happen to it, or what it means. This is just stuff that is formally stated to be mandatory in the header. Now, it wouldn't surprise you to know that the use of that top line, the line that says from, is to show to the people who get the message. So the message, when it turns up, there isn't a message here, this is just a header. The message, when it turns up, will say it comes from, and if I was clever, I would have remembered to check. No, that's just a pen. Is there a laser pointer? No, that's fine. I could just wave my arms. Not a problem. It would be surprising if this message didn't say Rodney Tillotson, from Rodney Tillotson. It could be presented in all sorts of other ways. There are variations on the syntax within that. It doesn't all have to be there, but that's normal. That's what comes in the message. Some mail programs will show you various subsets of that. So many of them will only show you this bit. And some of them will call that a name, and some will call it a freeform name. Yeah, go on.
Mail clients that I know don't show you that at all.
No, this is true. Mail clients will not show you this stuff. That's my issue. No, I'm saying this is actually what a message header is. Yes, good point. I mean, what you see on the screen is almost never that if you're a normal person. And that's the bit I was describing. What you will probably see is the first bit of that one and some other you may well do somewhere. Okay, tell me why I'm wrong.
No, what you'll see is what's in the message, not that.
Sorry, this is in the message. I'll come to that. Ah. Don't forget that, but let me go on, okay? No, there is a distinction between the protocol elements, the RFC 2821 and the 2822. And I haven't forgotten that, and I think I've got this exactly right. But tell me if I'm wrong. So the thing that's passed across the network and has ended up somewhere near you has actually got that and loads more at the top. There's not much there. There is a standard format, which a specified format for dates, and they do include a time zone at the end. The time zone is actually very useful and very important in diagnostic stuff and is therefore suppressed by most user agents. So it's, you know, there are issues about a lot of these things. Okay, but then there's no use. That would never fly. But that is actually, I think, the minimum specified. Now, in practice, a message that's been through the internet has also been subjected to the requirements of RFC 2821, which specifies the protocol for moving messages through the internet. Strictly speaking, that doesn't much use the message header. I'm not going to go into the whole sort of mail process, but there is a protocol that doesn't much depend on message headers. In fact, what it does is not to read anything in the message header. It writes some stuff. So I'm just going to have to move away from the microphone, I'm afraid. You will see there some things which were there before. This is mandatory in anything, and there's a date. And they've travelled on pretty much. This message almost certainly... nobody follows the standards. This is one of the rough bits about it. However, in normal use, most of this stuff will have to be added somewhere. So this is moderately realistic. The return path at the top may be what you were talking about. Now, return path is actually, you shouldn't see that in a presented mail message. It's a way of sticking into the message header after it's got to you, or pretty much after it's got to you, something about the protocol by which it travelled. The protocol exchange says, this is a message from somebody, and that goes, when you get it, goes in return path, and your user agent will probably not show you. The thing that starts received is it should be added by every box that handles the message on the way. There are some exceptions to that. And some boxes will add it twice. And there are all sorts of rules about where that should go. And received is probably the header that most people will have to worry about most. So I'm going to talk about that separately later. The things in red here are where this information comes from. I did say that the return path is actually copied from the mail from element of the protocol. And it's only copied in at the last stage, but it doesn't matter. That's been with the message all the way, but it's not part of the message header. It's commonly called part of the message envelope, and you can see the sort of analogy with postal mail. I'm not sure that's a very clever name either, but it's in the standard, so there it goes. So that's where return path comes from, and that should be there. There'll be lots of received ones. The various bits of these things come from other protocol elements. So hello there is part of the protocol at each stage in each hop of the message's movement. And this is a slightly informal indication that that's an IP address which the mail software should be able to extract from the actual connection. That is, an IP address is nothing to do with the mail. It's the, if you like, the layer 3 connection that resulted in an attempt to transfer this thing. So it's picked up lots of information and it's presented there. And the received lines are quite recently called trace lines. It's supposed to be a trace of where the message has been and a few other things have happened to it. Message ID. Things are supposed to have a message ID. It's not clearly explained who should add it. On the whole, the first thing that handles the message should add it. So this should be something fairly close to the origin of the message, and that's indicated by the bit after the at sign. That's here. That's not a mail address, just because it's got an at sign in, but it does look a bit like one. The right-hand side is supposed to be an indication of the thing that wrote that message ID. The message ID is supposed to be a unique indicator, so it's made unique by having a more or less unique right-hand side, and a left-hand side, which is kept unique. I just made up a date and a serial number. That's irrelevant. It can be shorter or longer. It's supposed to be globally unique when put with the other thing. What have we got? There's a two. Now, those, again, the distinction between the protocol, which actually makes the message move, and the header that sort of goes with it. The distinction is important here, because although it says it's two somewhere or other, it may not have been delivered to that mail address at all. The two are completely separate. And there is nothing proper in a message header, even when you look at it carefully, which says what the address was that ended up with this copy of this message. There may be other clues, but there's nothing formally there. Subject I've put in, it's not actually required by the standards or by 2821 to move the message, but it's good. Messages normally have subjects. And I've just also indicated a blank line. It can be more than one blank line, but this one is required, and then whatever stuff comes down here. Anything else I've got wrong? They're always longer, almost always longer. What's it for? It's a management issue, really. And you can see that in one or two of the header lines. The message ID is a management matter. It's possible to trace a message. There are sometimes other ways of tracking a particular message, but the message can be uniquely identified by its message ID. Systems and procedures that expect to track threads of messages can sometimes use that information. It seems more robust than I ever believe it can possibly be, but people do actually manage to track things that way. The other bits of management are not actually controlling the message, not that sort of management. It's knowing things about the message. So there is a lot of information that's going to come out of that. This stuff about hints from user agent of the sender or the originator and user agent of the receiver or person who's going to look at this, that from header line is intended to be displayed to the person who's reading the message. But the user agent doesn't have to do that. It can do whatever it likes. It can give you the other thing that actually was part of the protocol or something like that. However, I think it's fair to regard that as a hint from user agent to user agent. Have I covered all the complaints you're going to make?
Probably.
Okay.
It's not a complaint. I just think potentially you're going around explaining this the wrong way around.
Oh, right. Well, that's fine. Shall I get a bit further up into it and then you can...
No, I would have actually started with the conversation where the mail is delivered, okay. Because actually, if you follow that through, it's a lot easier to explain as to where bits of information come from.
Right. I will happily do that. I haven't actually prepared any visuals for that, so it'll be a lot of hand-waving. And I was intending to avoid it. Quite consciously intending to avoid it. I will say, I can do it in about 2 minutes, because I do this fairly often. When two boxes have to exchange a mail message, they first make a connection, and that's important because at that state, this is the sender, and this is the receiver. Apologies to those of you who are left-handed and right, or just going that way. Okay? This thing makes the connection. At the moment, I'm going to hit something in a minute. All this thing knows about it is the IP address at this end. And that's important because it's very difficult to spoof. It's not impossible, but in practice that's not an issue. So that's what it knows about the sender of this message. It came from here. It might have been somewhere else before, all sorts of things. But that's all it knows. So there's the connection. Now, the connection goes in simple phases. The first thing is this thing just says, I'm a mailer. Do you want to talk to me? And, you know, that's a stupid question, really, because that's why it connected. Hello is the first thing. If I just whip back, hello is, I won't do that. Hello is spelled H-E-L-O, or on some days of the week, E-H-L-O. And so this this machine here, this sender, says, hello, I am something or other. And it can lie about that. But all the same, you know, the receiver is picking up scraps of information. It might be true. It's worth recording. It's supposed to be a domain name. It might somehow match the domain name that you can derive from the IP address or something like that, or it might not. So there's hello, and then there's a positive response back. The next protocol element says mail from, so there's a verb mail and an argument from, and mail from, at that point, the sender says, here is the return path, and that's the thing that I did put up here. That's the thing up the top there. It's actually, it comes in the mail from protocol element. So it says mail from, and it only needs it doesn't have a freeform name, it's just that bit. Mail from something or other, and that gets duly recorded. It's not, the message hasn't turned up yet, by the way. And there's a positive response, we hope. The next thing is recipient two, and at that point the sender is actually going to passed off a mail address, and that is where this copy of the message will go. It's easy to worry about forging that. You can forge everything so far, by the way. Hello, and you can tell some rubbish. Mail from, and you can put whatever rubbish you like. The protocol is not too much concerned with that, and certainly most mail products are not. On the other hand, if you forge recipient to, you know, if you meant to put to spam alert and you put to spag alert or something like that, then, you know, it's a silly forgery. The message will just go somewhere else. It's not, forgery is not relevant to that. So you have these three basic elements. There's the hello, I am so-and-so. Mail from, this is where I would like errors to go back to. And this is, you know, you may think this is who the message is from, but that's up to you. And then recipient to, and that actually has some real effect on the real world. That determines where the message is going to go. And if all that's gone all right and the receiving mailer is happy with it in all sorts of senses, again, there's a positive response. And then there's the data command, which doesn't show here. And at that point, a whole lot of stuff goes across. The whole of the message goes across. Now, the interesting point is at that point, you need to know that the message includes the message header. So when I went back to this stuff, the thing that goes across the wire at that point, remember we had hello, mail from, recipient to, all sort of setting the stage, and then data, and what goes across is a header and a blank line and a body. Now, the whole thing's been set up without knowing what was in the header. The header takes no part in the transmission of the message, or its routing, or anything like that, or its final destination. That's the sort of point that you have to... You somehow got to distinguish these two things, and that was fair. And have I made enough of a distinction now? Okay. But people's eyes glaze over when you say protocol. I'm trying to avoid it. So that's really what I was banging on about with those things. And this thing, too... is not one of the protocol elements. It doesn't have to match one of the protocol elements, and so it doesn't actually take any part in deciding where the message ends up. It's pure fiction. And when I say it's a hint to the user agent, it is a hint to the user agent that your program will say this was supposed to be a message to somebody or other, and that's where it got it. That may be where it got it from. And there's nothing much else you can do with that two line. Okay. I'm capable of very dumb things on this, so I may have done something dumb. Do say. Right. So I was talking about hints there. That's what that one's from. This trace idea is quite important. Another function of the message header. Now, the thing we looked at before, there's not a lot of trace in that. There is some, but not much. But these received lines. Now, the surprising thing about those is a message starts off without any of those, and it picks them up as it goes along. The deal is that every time a mail system handles a message, and it can go through several hops on the way, it will stick one of these receive lines on. And by the way, I'm sorry, I'm calling them lines. They are notionally lines. There is a continuation mechanism, and the spaces over on the left-hand side are not a mistake. They indicate that actually that's a line, a single header element spread over several lines. So there's one that starts here, and the next one starts with message ID, and everything in between is actually all one line. Sometimes it's easier when you have an enormously wide screen and all the light, but they are very long. But at least you can sort of match up the elements and things like that, which you can't easily do with this presentation. The only interesting bit of syntax is that there's always supposed to be a semicolon and a date in the standard RFC 2822 format. There. Okay. Back on this lot. So message transfer agents, things that are handling this message, are not supposed to read those received lines. In fact, they're not supposed to read any of the header. It's just not for them. It's they're clearly not required to, and actually there are several points where the standard says you really shouldn't be looking at this. They shouldn't be making choices on the basis of what's in the header. They just have these three protocol elements to go by. Hello, which doesn't, you know, once you've done it, you've done it. Mail from, which is important in case the thing has to go back. And recipient to, which is actually causing the message to go somewhere rather than somewhere else. Message header lines, or message header fields as they're called, are extensible in all sorts of ways. The easiest one is anything starting with an X is guaranteed never to be standardized. and there are several that are quite common. So header lines that start with X hyphen are essentially private, but there are a few that are fairly well established. I'm not ever going to do a list of what all the legitimate things are. If you look at the relevant RFCs, which are fascinating bedtime reading, they're all listed there. Again, I've hinted at quite a lot of this. This is pretty much the same thing, but actually I've just put a bit more of its history. This is imaginary history. I've got some real history later on. And it's difficult to know in what order to deal with this. Pretty much headers are written from the bottom up. So the stuff at the very bottom probably came from me typing, from the user agent. Okay? And it's not too surprising. I would have typed a subject. There's no other way of getting a... Well, no, sorry. There has to be another way. But the obvious way for a subject is that it's some expression of human will and somebody typed it. The date I might have typed, but I probably didn't because computers have clocks on. Sometimes the clocks are right. I had something to do with this because there are still two things to remember. That is not the recipient two that actually decides where the message goes, but all the same, it is a way of indicating in a user agent, and I'm not going to go through all the behaviour of user agents either. Yeah, that's mail programs. But quite often they let you somehow construct a two line like this, and they make out of that a recipient two command. So it may in practice have been copied from this, but only at one point. Okay. The from, well, again, that's pure forgery. It doesn't mean anything at all. However, I have a program which puts that in every time, so that's how that goes. Okay. Message ID, most user programs don't bother with a message ID, and so technically they're not sending a valid message header with their message in their message. It doesn't matter because the next thing they talk to, which is a submission program or something like that, the first time it comes to a real mail program rather than just something on your desktop, it'll probably supply one. So here I've suggested this was supplied by, and here it comes, the originator MTA, as I think it's called in the standard. Anything wrong so far? Yes, lies, damned lies.
You can use real email programs to send mail to, like Pine, which will put on its own message ID.
Yes. Some do and some don't. And it's also there's also a protocol issue there. Some next hops expect it and some don't.
Okay. Yeah, it was the same command basically for Windows, for example. Both Outlook and Netscape put in the MUA puts in a message.
Fine. Thank you. I'm sorry, I had no idea the list of which. You can tell by looking afterwards, but by looking in received messages, usually there's some shred of indication here, not only of where it came from, but somewhere of what code did it as well. Okay, so there are gaps on the right-hand side here. That's because the elements up there are multi-line, so there's actually a complete match here. The next thing that happens to this message is that the thing that first got it from my imaginary desktop, which said it was called that. It's not a very good domain name for something, but it's what people call their PCs. So the first MTA it got to, which is called a relay MTA in the standards, wrote down all it knew. The box it got it from claimed to be RT, and it claimed in the hello bit of protocol. So it said hello RT. That's not good. Hello is supposed to be a domain name, and that's not a domain name. But that's the best you get quite often, so that's fine. It writes it down. It also knows the IP address it got it from. In this case, not one of great interest to the rest of the world, but there you go. And what it's supposed to do is to write who it is. And this one, received by, that's supposed to work. Now, unfortunately, what machines choose to use to describe what they are, to give themselves names, varies quite widely. Sometimes it's a Windows domain name. Sometimes it's just some piece of text in some etc. file. And sometimes it really does have some relevance to the DNS. And there's supposed to be a date stamp. We'll talk about that. So that was the first hop. This has gone from my desktop to some box that talks mail protocol. and notices that this thing was deficient in a message ID and has supplied it, and the thing goes on its way with the stuff up to here. The next box that gets it, and here it says received by something called UMHost, for reasons that I'm supposed to know but don't, and that has made the same sort of comments about it. It's managed to work out, I'm sorry I have to leave the microphone to say this, it says from cert.ja.net. Now that's what this box said it was. It says, hello, I am cert.ja.net. Actually, the receiving box knows better than that. It knows its IP address. It also knows that that it can also reverse translate that to this particular domain name. There's often a blank there for things that won't translate, but there is some real knowledge there. And obviously, to a human, it's pretty obvious that there's some reasonable consistency there. It's actually quite hard, and I shall comment on this later, to mechanically check the consistency. Yeah, there's a lot more to say about that. So that's what that receive line is about. And the return path really wasn't there at that stage. That it only sticks that on when the message is delivered as a highly technical term of dubious meaning, but at some point this stops being a message that's travelling by SMTP and becomes a message whose future is done some other way. And at that point it's supposed to write this return path up the top. All the mailers on this route, the first one said mail from, and that is actually, that's why it's called return path. The next box to which it said mail from, it's not supposed to make up a new mail from, except under some very strange circumstances. So mail from here, which is what I said, becomes the mail from that this one sends on, and so on and so forth. So actually, when you get to the end of it, under anything like normal circumstances, this thing which gets written down as return path is what the originator said was mail from. The name for it is actually return path in the RFC. So that's where all those bits came from. And this is all reasonably well behaved, I have to say. I mean, it's all made up as well, but there's some real ones coming. Any more lies? Okay. And most of this is really about trace information. Trace information is explained in the standards. Interestingly, they pick out just two items as trace information, return path and received. In practical terms, for doing tracing, you know, not what is formally called tracing, message ID is occasionally useful, and so are some of the others, but I've just picked it out here. And trace information, I just mean, no technical term there, I just mean how you somehow tell the story of this message. And it's the received one that everybody worries about, and there are usually most of those, and they usually contain more lies than... No, there are lies in the others as well, it's okay. This is spam. I've said most of this. There are other elements in a received line, but these are the ones that normally feature. From is derived from the hello. By is where the thing puts its own name. Remember, sorry, there are two parties in this. This is written by a receiving box, and it writes down its own name in by, so received by, and here it is receiving something. It says received from because and it gives some information about this end, but this end, all it does is to copy, at this point anyway, is to copy the hello that it gave, just like that. It actually fills in as well, or it should fill in, this is not beautifully spelled out. The IP address, it does know that. It doesn't know that because the other end wants it to know. It just knows it because that's how the network is. And it may be able to reverse translate the IP address into some sensible pointer domain, in which case all that is useful information and is supposed to be recorded. This is not a complete description of the syntax or even the sequencing of these things. Some MTA authors have decided that it'd be much better if it's slightly rearranged, and so they do that. And it's, in particular, you never quite know whether the thing after the from keyword is hello or the reverse IP address, reverse pointer. And the whole idea of this is that if you're really lucky, you can match up and make a chain of these things. I'll say some more about that. Because in an ideal world, for the hop to the left of this center line, this thing is the by. It says, I have just got this message. But the next hop, of course, this one is saying received by me. It's just saying received from this one. So the by in each line should be the same as the from in the one above, unless I've got it exactly the wrong way. It's quite obvious when you look at it. With a product is wrong there. That should actually be a protocol, or it's not much use. But it tends to, you tend to get a product name there. No, that's via. That's the protocol. You often do get something that indicates. This is where it usually says it's exchange or something of that nature. An ID is not the same as message ID. It's message ID is supposed to be a global thing. The message carries with it once it's got one to its destination. The idea of this is a QID, really. It's a local reference. It's meaningful to anybody who ever looks at the logs of the mailer, but it hasn't got much other significance. I think that's about all we can say. Okay. And as I say, different people write different versions of rubbish for this. But it's usually fairly clear. The worst confusion I've ever found is this distinction between what they put immediately after the from. Right, and I said they might chain together. They might indeed. This is a more or less genuine pair. And it says this was a message received by mail 1. And it was received from mail 1 at the next hop. So here it's been received from mail 1. So that's, you read these things from the bottom upwards. Well, sorry. The time flow is from the bottom upwards. You can read them either way. And so it goes on. You notice here that the times match quite well. But they don't have to. This thing could have sat on it for a week and then decided, in which case this would be, you know, would have been the 17th of September and this one would be the 24th of September. And there's nothing here that says why there was a gap of a week there. It could be the clock was wrong here or here, or they turned it off for a week, or there was some administrative policy that said you can't send mail here for a week, or the wires were cut, all sorts of things. You just don't know. A good match probably means what it says. Anything other than a good match, you have to guess. So this is all right. There's no problem there. Well, I made it. That's fine. This is tracing this. This is a message which looks all right. You can see some chaining working quite well here. Some of this, but not all, is real, by the way. It was a message that actually happened on 17th of September. So here we are, received by Rimmer, and then received from Rimmer. So that was a message that moved through that system. Down here, this was received by Sol 97, and then received from Sol 97 with a slightly different syntax, you notice. As I warned you, there will be duff syntax in some of this. And it all looks fairly plausible. And if a spammer had managed to get that into the header of a message, you would probably say, yes, this is a message that I know about this because that's me. But this is all very plausible. My messages come from here. And it looks really as if this Rimmer thing got it from... As if the previous hop, the Sol thing, got it from this place, and 200 is a plausible South American /8. So this is all probably. So I'll send off a complaint to these people, and they don't exist because I made them up. Because actually, the spammer didn't put that. They put these were. No, that's okay. I didn't change that one. Yes, I did. Sorry. This is what was actually in the spam message. Okay. Received from, and here is the place it really came from. And here, this doesn't even look as if it's realistic. This was a box that said it was talking to that address, 128.86. That's the next hop in this one, and it decided to say, "Hello, I am your IP address." An implausible opening to a protocol exchange, but anyway, the box swallowed it and it carried on, and here it is recorded for posterity. And this stands out a mile as something clearly daft. Nothing is supposed to say hello with that sort of stuff. If a thing doesn't know a better name for itself than somebody else's IP address, it's really not there at all. So that was clearly wrong, and in fact everything below that is rubbish. As soon as you see that, there's no point in reading the rest. This is syntactically incorrect in all sorts. Oh no, sorry. Message info is is a disputed thing. It has, apparently Microsoft writes it, some MSN writes it sometimes, but it also appears in spam for other reasons. And here you can see somebody who's decided to mention, no, not this one, I've forgotten it exactly. But this is bogus. It doesn't matter if it's bogus or not. The trail stops here. You've traced it back to there, and that's the end of it. This is the last history you've got for it, the earliest history you've got for it. All right on that? You get screenfuls of, you know, you go bog-eyed with this. I'm afraid that's how it goes. And, of course, the whole trouble with this is that, you know, true ones and false ones really don't look much different, but you have to look very carefully. And this is the sort of thinking, you know, who, suppose that you have to take the line. If you're worrying about spam, you look at this thing and it's a challenge. Somebody has tried to deceive you, okay? And you have to think who might have written each of these headlines, particularly the trace lines, and had they any motivation to get it right for you or to get it wrong for you? Were they trying to make you believe something wrong, or were they, you know, were they just neutral, and in which case they probably haven't bothered to get it wrong? It's easier to get it right than to get it wrong. So motivation is actually quite important. It's interesting when you get a report of some alleged abuse, which, of course, you know, it's just a piece of text that somebody's put in a mail message to you. They might have decided to frame somebody, so they've made this header look as if the abuse they had came from somebody, and it's nonsense. So that, there's no fix for that. People are going to send you lies as complaints. You have to find your own way of finding that out. It's hard. And, of course, what are you trying to find out? Is it a sort of academic interest in, you know, the true origin of this message? Because if so, it's fairly irrelevant. I mean, there clearly is a problem at the place where a bad message starts, but there's a bigger problem with the people way back who compromised that box so that it sent the message in the first place, and the people further back again who are the Russian mafia who are trying to do something, and they've actually paid the script kiddies to do, you know, for a couple of thousand of these boxes or whatever it may happen to be. True origin is actually quite an interesting phrase. But you may be able to find the start of the SMTP journey, the Internet Mail Journey. You may want to know who is involved in this, which ISP do I have to break down the door of. Just don't make a habit of it, that's all. You may actually have, a slightly academic interest in, you know, we thought we weren't getting these messages. Where has it come from so that we do get it? And that's another kind of issue that people come up with there. Two, I think. An interesting idea in this, and I'm going to look at, again, at this sort of truth and falsehood, is that the last hop, you know, a message has started here. It may have gone through quite a lot of mailers, but in the end, it enters your system or your ISP's network or something. And there's a point, you sort of trust your own system. You may really trust it if you drive it. You may trust it because you're paying somebody else money to look after it. Or you may just happen to know its behavior and know it's all right. But there's a step before that, which is fairly critical, because that's where you sort of run out of trust and you have to make some guesses, really. So this last hop is an important thing to think about. I've said most of this. If it's your own box, you've got some logs, which should show all this and some other things as well. I mentioned there, and this—that's what the last hop is about. The delivery domain is not a technical term, a piece of jargon. I just made it up. If you're a Hotmail user, then your messages will at some point stop being in a BT machine and end up in a Hotmail machine, and it won't be the one that delivers it to you or anything like that. They'll go through several, but that transfer from BT to Hotmail is critical. And that's worth finding out about. Not too subtle here, but if you're at all suspicious about mail, you don't believe anything in this until you have to. Spammers lie, and other mail abusers lie, and everything has to be supposed false until you have some reason to know it's true. Now, you may have good reasons for knowing that last hop is correctly recorded. You may not bother to analyse it every time, but you may just know this box never lies. That's okay. So you probably get good trust reading down the header to about that point. And you have to start looking for flaws everywhere after that, for things that don't match. If the times don't match, I mean, obviously they may be in different time zones, but once you've sorted that out, if there's more than a few minutes before the times, you have to, you know, you should There has to be a good reason for that. If IP addresses don't match, either real IP addresses because they're recorded as IP addresses in square brackets, or things that you've derived from domain names, and it, quite often you can do some reverse checking if you've got nothing else to do all day to find that things that are supposed to match but actually look like different pieces of text really are the same thing. I won't say that, sorry. Another good giveaway is that the rules say that received lines, these are these things that every hop on the way is supposed to add, are supposed to go up the message. So the first one, there should be one, there should always be one somewhere. And then everything's supposed to just put it on top. And there's not supposed to be anything in between any of those. If there's anything in between, then almost certainly the spammer put in the thing underneath and the thing in between. And they're almost always false. I don't know a circumstance where anything legitimately does otherwise. The standard is fairly clear about that. Although some old mail programs may not get it. Okay, so you may actually have found where truth sort of finishes. On the message weight here, you know something here, and at the other end you don't know, and somewhere in between you run out of steam, and that's what this is about, really. You just have to go through these things. Backwards, let's say, from the top. Top one you probably trust. You may recognise some of them, the others, and suddenly you say, I have got no reason to believe that. In that case, it's probably not true, and you have to do some more work if you're still caring about listening. It's all very time consuming. Most of us have got lives to live, but people do worry. Okay, now in real honest mail, this was all designed for when people didn't hate each other and mail was supposed to just go through in a cooperative arrangement, and actually it all works quite well. Things do match up. Just saying it all, message IDs do have the right domain written in them. This is the thing that says message ID, and it has an at sign and it's supposed to have some domain. It's probably got the right one in. Originator addresses, the mail from and the from and everything else that's a bit like the sender and reply to and all sorts of things, if they're there, will probably all be the same and they'll all be very reasonable and they'll correspond somehow to the box that sent it and things like that. Dates and timestamps will, in receive lines, the trace will show a historical progress with not too many reversals or gaps of 3 weeks or anything like that. Or in the case of some spammers, miraculous time warps by a couple of years. And, it's a bit of a giveaway, really. But it has to be said that... this is another quite nice one. You should smell a rat if you get a message that says it comes from a South American IP address of 200-something, but then claims to have a time zone of +3 or something like that. Because it clearly doesn't mean what it says, and you have to find out what it does mean. So that's quite an interesting one. A lot of this is rather subjective. I'm afraid that's how it is. Well, here's one I did earlier. I don't think it's worth spending a lot of time on this. This is real, and it just all works. So we've got here a thing that says received by mail 1, and there it says received from mail 1, and here it's received by mhub 2, it's received from mhub 2, and this one that says received, if I get this the right way around, by that thing, and then it's received from that thing. So, that's telling the story. The dates all line up all the way. In fact, 3 seconds to traverse the network and 0 recorded seconds for boxes are probably next door to each other or maybe the same one. You see some slight variations in the presentation of received lines. Postfix does one lot of things and Exchange does another. Not much difference there. Oh, XSIM does different things. There's an XSIM there. XSIM is the one that is one of the ones that messes around with where the hello entry goes. Message ID, again, all very plausible. It says something that seems to be from the right place. And that's, good mail just looks like that, and you don't bother to read it. Nobody ever sees this one. Okay. This is also real. This is fairly obvious, but by the time it reaches your screen, nobody had to read this message to know that it was a load of rubbish. If I see on my list of summary lines that it says they cheat, my imagination goes into overdrive, but I also press the delete button, so that's fine. And practically nothing matches here. This is a genuine hop. I trust that. I know this box. I know something about it. And then it all falls apart. You know, it's just nothing. Nothing is working here. So this Crichton machine was told if it got a message from there, which is, as far as I know, pure fiction. It's certainly got nothing to do with what Crichton really did know, which is this IP address. Okay. I may have forgotten this one, in which case it's possible they match up, but I don't think so. There's no other mistakes in that one. The date that was written by the Crichton machine, and it's all very plausible. It got rid of it fairly quickly as well. But this is not good here. And so you smell a rat, and you're inclined to think that nothing below there is going to be any. And this is not even syntactically sound. It's just not all there. This isn't good enough. You should never have an IP address there. Now, it can happen. Remember, this is probably the hello, and if something says, hello, I'm 181, whether it's a lie or not, that's what it's got, and so a box will write that in. But actually, it's so far below where the established truth finishes, it's just not worth worrying about. I blame this box, not this one. And then there's a message ID which something has put in, which is syntactically sound, and it does sort of match the return path, but they haven't any relation to anything else in the message header, so they're presumably just nonsense. The thing just doesn't hold together there. The date is interesting. This date, that's 2348 on the 17th, and that's 2348 on the 17th. So those are probably talking about the same date, but this is a different date, isn't it? No, that's the same date. The dates are okay in this one. Sorry, bad example. And that is what tends to happen. That the IP address giving us a hello. It shouldn't happen. It's not what the standard says. It does happen sometimes. So here's something that came that we got in this box here. Mail one I trust. Mail one was told it had got something from there. Now, actually, it didn't come from there at all. What mail one actually knew was it had got an IP address. It can tell where the connection is from, by delving down into the mail. The mail program has to get that from some operating system service. They're not difficult to do. And this is where it actually had the connection from. So nothing else matters very much. It's all rubbish. This happens to be syntactically possibly just right, but it's clearly nonsense. Nothing that wants to help you is going to write that. And this is a pretty bad message. I mean, it's full of 8-bit characters, which I cannot represent here, wouldn't wish to represent here. And so there's a subject. Oh, this is the one where it doesn't work. This is an improper form of address, and if I've got it right, 02GMT. Yes, this is a fairly common sign. Here we've got the same text for a time, 02.34.12, but they're actually in different time zones, which usually means that it was just presented as text at some point by something that didn't know or care about time zones, such as a spammer's script. And that's probably what happened to that one. So, you know, most of it just doesn't hold together. Not too bad. Any questions? Soon finished. This is anti-spam, so why do we bother? In case you can't identify spam any other way, this does help a bit. On a good day, if you plough through this looking for the true bits and where the false bits are, somewhere on the boundary there is an IP address from which this stuff came. And you should be able to find the ISP responsible. Now, it's up to you whether you bother to wake them up every time one of their boxes sends something. But in a sense, you need to know that. Clearly, if you could automate that and just send them once a day, so I had these 16,000 IP addresses of yours that were all doing this, I'm sure they'd love it. But actually, this is just that spammers can make it just hard enough not for for automation not to work very well. That's what this is about, really. Things that automate it, including SpamCop, will get it wrong sometimes. And if you're going to be rude to people, it's best not to get it wrong very often. Something I find myself doing quite a lot of times is I'm presented with a thing that says, this is all your fault. Your network has been sending spam, and you have to plow through it and discover, bearing in mind this was probably a message that never came near our network, where somebody has inserted a lie saying it was one of ours. So I can politely or otherwise reject a complaint. The level of politeness in the response, of course, corresponds to the level of politeness in the complaint. The other catch is that they're getting better at this. I mean, if I was trying, certainly by hand, to write things to stick below the real receive lines that seemed to join up and were quite hard to distinguish from the truth above them, I could do it by hand. I could fool most people most of the time. And the spammers are getting better at it. I make mistakes. I tell some of our customers, I think this came from you, and they say, no, it didn't, look at this so-and-so. You get it wrong. And the spammers are getting better at it. I can produce, I have about 6 megabytes of examples. By ad nauseam, I mean ad nauseam. If anybody's not already sick, I'll do some more. But, they've got some real things. But they're actually quite hard to display. They're very, very long. They don't make good screenshots. But I have got some of you, and I can probably find any particular thing. That's where it's going to stop. Over time, sorry about that. Anybody want to ask anything or complain about anything? Just one.
Well, actually, I would like to ask you a question which is not necessarily related to what you have presented so far, but it is related to the message headers. Namely, the RFC requires that the hello message contains either a domain name or an IP address, an FQDN or an IP address. Is it something that, let's say, the community could recommend to reject messages which where the sender doesn't present such a hello? Because in one of your examples, you had the R2 and something like that. You gave exactly that kind of example. So is there any kind of recommendation one could give to the ISPs, for example, to reject such mail?
Has anybody else got a view on this? I have two views. One is what you say is very reasonable. The other is that it's exactly what it doesn't say in the standards. You are expressly and explicitly forbidden to turn down anything on the basis of a bad hello. Now, this must have seemed a good idea 20 years ago.
I was just going to say, the RFC, as you say, where entirely possible to accept all mail and then send it back rather than actually drop it at session.
Well, so you've actually got... No, it's not a general matter. They specifically say that about hello.
The only thing you're allowed to reject on, and there's still debate on that, is if the receipt to address is to do with... if they're trying to relay through you, basically, that's when you can do it. That's the only thing you're meant to drop that session on.
Yes. Okay. I'm... Yeah, all right. The standards have not served us well in this sort of detail, I think. I don't know. What do people think? What should you be prepared to give up on?
Most of the mail I see coming from PCs in my university does not have reasonable information in the hello. This is a problem with the user agents. The user agents don't do it properly, and I see no sign of that changing.
Okay, there is an easy fix for that. You can just say that actually it doesn't have to be SMTP within your sort of management domain. If you can do whatever you like internally, so long as what you send out is protocol compliant. And so if you choose for your own convenience to do something that looks like SMTP, but it's actually slightly different internally, that's quite acceptable. I don't see a contradiction in that. It may be that you've got software that, if you tell it to do it for those, will do it for something else as well, which is not so good. So, you know, there is a bit of an issue, but the issue is not... there's a good way around that. And people will tell you that this relay MTA, this submission MTA, or message submission agent, whatever it's called, can actually have entirely different behaviour in all sorts of senses. You know, in many cases, it's not getting a message ID. It may not be getting a date. And those are formally sins, but actually, you know, this is a reasonable arrangement, and you can do that. So, yeah, fair comment. The question was, should we be throwing away things with Duff Hellos? I wouldn't wish to pronounce, but if there is any consensus, Peter.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say that one shouldn't mix policy with protocol. So everybody is free, of course, to drop any connection where in the hello string there is the letter capital X, as long as they document that and as long as they can sell that to their customers. Then all that information or all that strings following the hello are rather pointless. So there is no value or non-value, say, in forging that information. There are worse things to do with the SMTP protocol. I, for a couple of years, believed that just send 8 is bad. So what I did on our mail surveys, I rejected mail which didn't really declare the transport and encoding and so on and so forth, up to the point where my customers convinced me somehow to do otherwise. Because, the point is, me in the meantime, those compliant to the protocol are mostly the spammers. We have educated them by being the protocol police. So they have adapted to the protocol while not all other implementations did, or they may have done, but still out in the field there are old implementations. The next point is, another example is 8-bit in headers, which is slightly different from just send 8 and which is even worse. I am hard to my customers on that part. But once in a while, someone is complaining that mail doesn't arrive. And that is because maybe some really large, not internet provider, but content provider or whatever system on the internet doesn't make it. They just send 8-bit in headers without declaration or MIME encoding. So you can't just...
This would normally be UTF encoding of...
you would normally have this MIME encoding of non-US ASCII in...
this is where it's come from. They haven't deliberately done that. Yeah, they're just using a character set that doesn't...
Yeah, exactly.
They needed encoding and they haven't encoded it.
They're just Perl, Java, Python, whatever, and then shoot and forget. So what I'm trying to say is, being the protocol police has some of my sympathy, but I have, to me, somehow painfully learned that it will, to a certain extent, keep out the spammers, but then they learn where the others don't. And finally, you end up with a clean protocol for some values of clean, but then you keep out the legitimate senders and not the spammers. And then you can't really explain to your users why you're doing all this. So this is... Yeah, it may help to a certain extent, but spammers learn very rapidly. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you for that encouraging note. Unfortunately, it's exactly right. They have nothing else to do all day. They're making their living out of this. Should you be turning things down on bad hellos? Probably not in practice. This is what everybody has said. And clearly the standards have, for completely different reasons, probably said that. It's probably not workable. However...
what we're doing at the moment is, there's this one situation we'll drop on hello, which is a single word hello. which we will drop on for everything bar the machines, the authorized machines, which are connecting to the mail server as just them. But any external SMTP connections which start off with a hello that isn't an FQDN will just get dropped.
Presumably what you pick up with that is individual PCs that are making direct connections.
Yeah. I think we've had one false positive. We contacted the guy. He went, oh, right. I'll change that now. And everything else has been spam drops. So that's working very well for us. It may not be exactly what one is supposed to do, but it has dropped a large volume of spam off what we're receiving. So.
That's fair.
Sorry. If we receive a hello, which is just a single word, so which would tend to be just a machine trying to connect on its own. Yes, it's not a fully qualified domain name, just a single word.
Okay. Anything else to worry about there? It's wonderful stuff if you've got nothing else to think about, I'm afraid. And the, you know, the tricks of, you can hear what's happening, it's really a mess about deciding just what you will throw out and what you will decide is not good enough for your own local rules and stuff. And I try not to get into that in these meetings. But the comments we've had have been useful. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, well, a bit delayed, we got to there. The database working group have an issue which others will talk about better than I can probably, which they, on some days of the week, they will say came from us. Now, we certainly did present this to them. The issue is about, we're talking about setting up some abuse contact, it's ended up with this name, somewhere in the Whois database. To do these things, really, to make it more, and it's intended to indicate who you should complain to about an IP address. A related matter, which is not quite the same, is to make sure that you don't offer too many wrong addresses, so that what happens at the moment is suppressed a bit, that everything that comes up, and I think this is my next. Yep, here we are. This is not supposed to be readable. That's the smallest font I could manage, except for the mail addresses. If you just type, you know, you just ask for an ordinary Whois lookup, default lookup, you get, I think it's 9 mail addresses, none of which is the one that abuse report should have been sent to. And with that being presented to the world, it's not surprising that abuse is, you know, is generally not well reported. That's the problem that it's trying to address. Now, there are lots of different ways of approaching it. Does anybody want to say I've got all this wrong? I mean, I haven't got all this wrong. It's just what came out of the thing. But I don't think I've... you can make excuses for all these things. They're all quite legitimate, and they're there. They just don't mean what the people who get them up on their screens think they mean. And these are the sort of options. We can just carry on with our lives. And that is fairly effortless. Fairly effortless while we're here, but it means we continue to get all this stuff, which people are beginning to regard as bad news. We have probably that is an option. If you don't do nothing, let's say if you're going to do something, you could do any combination of these things, and I may have got the flavours not accurate in detail. Okay, you can ensure that every inetnum or similar entry has got a thing in it that is a mail address and says it's an abuse address. So it might be called abuse mail or something like that. And so at least that will come up on the screen if somebody just types who is. Okay? And it will have the word abuse in it, and so they can grep for abuse, or their scripts can, you know, they will find the right thing that way. There are problems about that. You've got an awful lot of inetnums that have got to be updated. You can instead stick an abuse role into the inetnum. That has much. The point about a role there is that this is a level of indirection, really. That the mail address you're looking for is somewhere else. So the default action of just typing who is, it doesn't come up, but something comes up that says it's got the word abuse in it, hasn't got a mail address. So, you know. And there are issues about deploying that. Again, an awful lot of inetnums. But the indirection does mean that the maintenance issue may be a little bit easier. There's this wonderful IRT thing, which some people love and some people hate. which is a neater way of doing the indirection. And because it, you don't actually have to attach things to each INET number. You can inherit them from somewhere else. So that is actually slightly easier from that point of view to make the transition to, and slightly easier to maintain. A variation on that is that the IRT object is much despised by some people, and it has got an issue about requiring a PGP key in it. So there could actually be a simplified one that didn't, so it's a slight variation. And the other kind of approach, which the database people are worried about with some justification, is to change the default output of whois. So that actually if you send a whois query reaching the, which is essentially just an IP address, reaching the right server, does not return this great load of stuff. What it does instead is to do whatever lookups it needs to somehow distill an abuse address from whatever it is it needs to distill it from, and presents that instead. Okay? Or as well, or you know, there's some toing and froing there. I think those are the four sort of categories of things. Now, just before Marco says some real thing, because he knows more about this than I do, we have, you know, do we care about this? Because if we do, we ought to do something about it. I think we probably do care a bit about it, just seeing that the number of heads that wag slightly. Can we come to a consensus on what is on any of the things that are the right way to do it, or are the wrong way to do it? And that we'll talk about for a bit. And either way, I would like to take a clear signal to the database working group tomorrow. So, you know, if we can, even if we, whatever we decide, it's worth noting, but it is going somewhere else, so we're trying to get it right. Marco knows all about this and has some wonderful stuff to tell us.
Only one small comment. The new IRT RIPE has assured that in the next database version, the encryption field will be optional on the IRT object.
Right, so that's less of an issue. That particular. Does that remove enough people's objection to the use of the IRT object?
Might be that some people start using it. The core of the problem is that IRT object carries an attribute called email, and which is the main issue. Some other options.
Can I just explain what the issue is there? That the whole point of this is that something should come back that says abuse, and if it says IRT, that isn't abuse, and if having said IRT, it says email, that isn't abuse either. That's roughly what the issue is.
Yeah, Aaron implemented some form. If you do whois lookup against the Aaron server, you will get abuse email back instead of an attribute called email. Some of the other options are to at least change the changed attribute to hold NIC handles instead of email addresses.
That's all these and some of the others as well.
That will definitely, in your case, will take away six email addresses. Then
should take all except one of those. Yeah, I think that's right. Okay.
So that's basically it. In the database working group tomorrow on the agenda.
Yes, quite. So is that a reasonable summary? That, you know, you've worried about this more than I have, so that's fair. Right, is there anything else that people don't understand about this? Or wish to make comment on?
I have a possibly slightly naive question.
Can you tell the folks at home who you are?
Yeah, sure. I'm Alex Bly from, who shall I be from today? Inovi LLP, I think. If you're a local IR and have a customer with a /28 or something like that, who's filling in this abuse C? Because presumably, as the local IR, it's you who's filling this in. And being a great believer in indirection, I wonder whether this is going to necessarily result in abuse C at the customer level that is accurate and maintained. Clearly, it's going to be maintained in respect to the local IRs /19 or whatever they're delegating from. But down at the customer level, I wonder whether it is going to be likely to be maintained. I just have a wacky idea about why not insert an MX record in ADRA or ARPA, which would give you a way of sending effectively an MX abuse record to any IP address anyway, which is probably off the wall. But the central point is, I wonder whether these things are going to be maintained.
Fair question. I can think of several different answers. Here's the right one.
James Blessings on Internet. The change default value of who is the output anyway would be very much appreciated, because then the MD would stop getting abuse complaints.
That is the sort of benefit that would arise from that.
It would be great, except for our range is just next to Saudi Arabia, and if you do lookups on certain things, you get us in by mistake.
Okay. Yes, incidentally, a very bad set of addresses to have is those close to 192.168. They get a lot of complaints about things. The reasons are slightly different, but so. Okay, so that's called this business of firstly the transition effort and then the ongoing maintenance is important. I don't know. We could propose a policy on, we could suggest a policy on that. Although I think there are plenty of people in the database working group who will happily chew over that one, and they may even do it in a finite time and come up with something. I mean, have you any sort of suggestions about that, Alex? Did you want to say we should do it one way rather than another? No, fine. Okay.
I suggest we do something, though.
Okay. Well, so we.
I suggest we push the database working group to make some sort of decision on this and get moving. On the issue of maintenance, you want something that can be defined for a block and then redefined for delegations of that block, so that tools out there which automatically find who to complain to will find the one nearest the bottom.
Yes, the issue of tool writers is an interesting one. We think that the number of tool writers is actually very small. And so whatever complexity they're presented with, they may be able to fix it in a fairly good time frame. It's the great unwashed who will just type who is and get all this stuff that I think are the target of this stuff. I may have misjudged that. The other question about strongly representing to the database working group, the door is pretty much open today and tomorrow, as luck would have it. Is that fair? Okay. So, you know, if we have a clear view, it will actually go somewhere. So that was worth saying. Marco again?
Yeah, it's Marco Diemen again. Commenting on the maintenance issue, I gave a small presentation on RIPE 47 in Amsterdam about this, and if Rodney can go one slide back, I think, to his wish output, you will see there in the tiny print some things with remarks for other contexts, see, and a URL. I did a count, about 10% of the INetNum objects contains a remark field pointing to the abuse address. That definitely is a maintenance nightmare. So whatever we implement, it will not get worse. Things might be more maintainable as they are now, because everybody uses a freeform attribute.
That's fair in a steady state, but there is also a transition issue. If you're correct, well, I'm going to put words into your mouth. Roughly speaking, you're saying there's something there already, and putting something else in doesn't change that, except that you've got to do it once.
I was going to say that our record contains the full details of who to complain to. The problem is,
as remarks,
yeah, people do not read them. They just go, oh, email address, bang, copy, paste, and send it to everybody.
I think that's right. I think there are some relative successes in that, where there is an email address in the remarks, and it's got the word abuse. But that's a, you know, we shouldn't be doing that to people. That's an overloading of comment. We shouldn't do it. Okay, well, I don't know what we do here. I think we probably have to try and... We seem to have a sort of vague consensus that we should ask the... we should say to the database working group that from an anti-spam and abuse point of view, this is actually something we'd like to get fixed somehow. Is there any dissent from that? Does anybody disagree with that? It's worth some effort by somebody else at the moment to do it. Okay, that's a consensus to record. Oh, this is a good moment.
As the chair of the database working group tomorrow, I intend to get something decided. Who knows what it will be, but something will be decided.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Thank you. And what we seem to be saying is that we're asking for it not to be choice zero, do nothing. That's right. Okay. Can we refine that at all? I haven't really picked up that anybody says we should do it one way rather than another yet. We've had a vote for doing something with the WHOIS output, but I believe that almost everything you want to do with that actually requires you to do some of the others as well.
Brian Nisbet from HENS, an additional voice for the bottom part as a primary goal of this, as I have an email sitting in my inbox there, which I think has somewhere in the region of 40 email addresses for a single abuse complaint, most of which appear to be mine. Bar Lear, who I've just been talking to, has avowed a wish for possibly the IRT solution as one of the options, especially if the problem with that has been removed to some degree. So that's just what the office have just told me to say. Okay.
I think there are some good things. I don't want to sort of bore people by trying off the cuff to describe what the IRT object does in this context, but it may be necessary because it's getting more votes than I expected, I'm afraid. Is there anybody who has a prepared speech about the IRT object? I'm quite happy to sort of wing it, but that's what it would be.
I think the less indirection there is, the better. So if somebody can type in who is and a line is returned that has the string abuse on it, I think that would be best.
Okay, but that's fine. That's down at this level, isn't it? Okay?
Not necessarily. You could just... leave the existing email addresses there, which isn't ideal, but add another line with abuse in it somewhere.
There's actually a proposal, in fact I think there's an action, on the RIPE NCC to actually return the IRT object when a query is made on when a WHOIS query is made on an INET NUM, which does actually answer that question.
Oh right, as a default action. Default behaviour. Okay, right. And it's returned in such a way that an email address comes up.
I presume it'll be returned just like the person object is returned when you do a WHOIS query.
Okay.
Yeah, it's basically making the, I believe it's the minus C flag, making it basically default on. So you will get an IRT object if it's present for that object. And it will list the normal details, show a couple of email addresses, including the changed.
Oh yeah, quite. So you get actually more changed addresses. That's fine. Do not be ashamed to say this. Is there anybody who wants me to try and explain how the IRT object works? Okay, one. There's always one. Well, anybody who knows better, please interrupt me at any stage. IRT is Incident Response Team. This is CERT teams like me. Wishing to register that they cover whole sort of lumps of address space, whole areas of address space. So there is this object which can be there's an IRT object. It has a number of attributes, and it has a PGP key, some authentication tokens, and the usual kinds of things that a role type object would have. And it has quite funny arrangements for authorising its linking to other objects, particularly INET NUMs and INET 6 NUMs. And the INET NUMs and INET 6 NUMs have it as an optional attribute. if I'm getting the words wrong, do stop me. So that it's possible to attach it to there. It's also possible to attach it to larger entities, such as routes. So that if you can't find an IRT reference in an INetNum block for a particular IP address, then the -C flag instructs the database to go prowling around a bit and find something that encloses that, that has got an IRT object, if there is one. So there is actually, there is some inheritance there, and there's also some efficiency in actually, if you've got a whole lot of address space divided up into tiny bits, you probably don't need to do anything to all of them. So transition is probably two orders of magnitude less work on that one. But these things aren't widely used. They are thought of as these sort of super secret leap things that only fascinating people like me and Wilfred know anything about. You see, this is a shame, and that's why something with a different name might be more acceptable to the world. But that's not there at the moment. Making a couple of changes to the existing IRT object object class might actually be more satisfactory. So I hadn't rehearsed this at all, so I hope I said about the right amount about that. That there is this thing which has the capability of reaching down, but you can also refer to it from within any level of detail you want. The worst thing about it is that it hasn't got an abuse email attribute. So it might be worth not only making this change, so you don't need to have a strong authentication token, but also giving it another attribute, which is the abuse mail. It would then be possible, whenever this works, to have a default behavior of whois that if it possibly could, ferret it around in these things, and for all I care, it only has to give a single line, just grep for abuse, and up comes one mail address, which is the right one. There are issues about what happens when there isn't one, and what you do with stuff. So that is, I think, how it would work. And I don't know whether people think it sounds daft or not.
Even if you stick abuse in the IRT object, which sounds jolly good, you've got abuse at isp1.net or something in there from a gentleman whose name I forgot who had his typical abuse email with 40 things in the header. The problem is that people either go through lists of these whois outputs manually or more often with some very helpful automatic program and extract every email address that's there. So the question is not only what email addresses do you return when you make a whois query against an IP address, and if the default is that the IRT object is returned, clearly if there's an abuse content in there, that's good. There's a subsidiary question, which is what email addresses don't you return? For instance, is it sensible not to return all of the changed, maintained by, blah, 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 blah things when there's a query on a single IP address?
Yeah.
Or does not doing that mean that the problem that was identified over there is not fixed?
Suggestion made on the mailing list was to, by default, suppress everything which is only relevant to maintainers. So that's notify, update to, changed. Maybe even the suppress the maintainer object from being returned.
Okay, so that would answer that. I have one other bright idea which nobody ever argues with, but nobody quite seems to think is worth doing. That you can't call them two default behaviours. You could have the present behaviour, the present fairly raw behaviour, available on a slightly different domain name. And the issue then is whether you change the real default that people get by typing minus h whois.write.net to this one, or whether you leave it as it is at present, so as not to upset people, and they have to know that they actually go for whoisn't.write.net or something like that. It seems to me that there's probably a way of managing that there. I don't know. So. Well, there you are. Somebody wanted to know about IRT objects, and they've got some something going for them in this context, and they've also got some problems. But so is everything else. Has anybody? I don't know how to do this, but How many people think just doing that's a good idea? One and a half, two, yeah, three. That's good. Okay. This is different because that's a role, that's a level of indirection. How many people think that's a good idea? One. Thank you, Peter. Let's take the whole of this lump together at the moment. How many people think this sort of thing is a good idea? Yeah, there are other things as well. That's okay. But
each means not necessarily hierarchical hierarchy.
There is some hierarchical behaviour there, inheritance. Yeah, okay, that's enough. Thank you. And again, these are not exclusive. You see, how many people think this is a good idea? Okay. Well, thank you. I mean, without recording any numbers, what we have at the moment is that the combination of this and this is probably worth doing. Does anybody wish to, you know, wish to really argue with that?
Basically, the whole IRT is all done, already done. Yeah. Well, at least the next version will make PGP optional, which hopefully let more people create IRT objects and put them on the objects. So it's there. Yeah, you can't force an LIR to put it in. You can make the main IRT attribute online at NUM to be not optional, but in the end, you have to fill it the moment you do it.
Okay.
So I guess that the whole IRT thing is already there, and the rest is open for discussion.
Okay, so the issue is not actually writing code to do this, it's preparing a deployment plan where we actually persuade people to do it. That's the issue. So you were not actually arguing with my summary of what people felt. That was just...
Maybe what we need is a who is minus abuse that returns one email address and nothing else.
That would be another way of doing it. Yes, something of that's clearly down in this department, isn't it? Yeah. You have an issue there about things where the code cannot identify the one address.
That's the point I was going to make. Okay, if you want that, you need to put it in the database at first, and there's still a discussion going on how to put it in the database. When it's in the database, it should be easy to make a flag and return it.
Yes.
In terms of
reporting. No, I can't. Sorry. Walk to another one. Or fix it.
I think that's fixed it. In terms of reporting out, it seems to me that there have been certain issues that have been identified from a spam handling point of view that we should be reporting out, such as making it easier to find the right abuse address, not making it easier for tools to do it by not having it in freeform fields, making it easier to not find things, other things when you're looking for it, such as maintainer addresses and so forth, that we should be reporting out as being essentially the requirements from a spam handling point of view. But exactly how to go about implementing this, I mean, it's way outside my expertise. I suggest it's really something for the database working group. If we report out really what the spam handling requirements of this are, and let them sort out exactly how to go about implementing that, I'd suggest.
No, that's quite fair. But you know, the history of it is that they seem to need some sort of guidance if we can do it. So that was the question. You know, can we actually suggest something, as well as saying there is a requirement?
I didn't just mean a requirement. I meant trying to get more clearly and precisely what the requirements are.
Spell this stuff out, really.
Yes, so I mean, when you were saying changing the default output, it's actually going into more detail about what are the problems with the output and how would you want that changed, not in terms necessarily of whether it's a minus abuse or whatever flag to the... to the tool, but instead the issue that the most common use of this tool by the great unwashed is for looking for the spam for abuse handling addresses, and therefore we want that to be taken into account for how the default is handled, or that kind of statement, as opposed to exactly how it should be done. I'm sorry, I'm being a little unclear here, but...
No, I do understand. You're trying to separate the sort of requirements from the implementation.
Yes.
But I think in this particular case, the database working group have become a little bit stuck on a sort of conflict between implementations and some notion of coming up with some ideas that look as if they make a set of things that can be made to work is probably valuable, probably worthwhile. Is that not an unfair imposition on the working group, is it? Okay, so fair comment. And if we need to spend time spelling that out, that's okay. I mean, that was the best I could do in two sentences, you know, two half sentences, because those are the issues, aren't they? But if anybody wants to make up some words to go with that I agree, so that's fine. Okay, so our message is, sorry, I keep dodging about, please do something. We think there is a way forward. Sorry, please do something that addresses these two issues. Okay, we think there is a way forward by exploiting what is or is nearly in the IRT object, and by changing the default behaviour of who is. Does anybody want to quarrel with that? Because it's going to go forward as from the anti-spam working group, and I don't wish to be misrepresenting anybody. Thank you. Right. Yes, this one I am less well prepared for. Sorry, unfortunately it's moderately urgent. Hands up if you've ever looked at RIPE 206. Well, that's not bad, is it? Thank you. Five people. Thank you. Okay, no, it's not too difficult to find. I can get it up on my screen, on this screen, in a few seconds if necessary. It may actually be something to do. The issue is that it was very closely linked with a document from the Links, who had written a BCP on what sort of policies you should have within your own ISP network and with your own ISP customers about spam and stuff. And essentially, all we did was to slightly internationalise it, because it talked about some English law and things like that, and top and tail it with the RIPE header stuff, and that was it. They've now changed it, of course, which is as it should be. And really, we ought to consider updating the RIPE document. Of course, for anybody who hasn't seen either of them to make a sensible comment, it's going to be difficult. Essentially, the most important change is that there was a whole area of stuff that wasn't a problem at the time, and so it wasn't written into it. And it is this sort of spam supporting activity where if you have customers who are using your address space to host things which are advertised using UBE, then that's the same crime as actually sending the stuff. If you somehow allow spam tools to be marketed from your bit of the address space, that's the same crime. So it gets those things included. I have some of the text that I can make visible. This would involve me sitting down and typing and changing my glasses. This is new text. I believe it's new text. And I think it's the major part of the new text. And I'm sorry it's not wonderfully legible, but I have to think of some way of doing this. So there are two clauses. An AUP clause. This is at the end of the document. There's some discussion of this earlier on, but at the end of it, there's some specimen clauses which ISPs are encouraged to include in their contracts to actually implement some of the principles. And these are two new ones. So the top one is a clause to prohibit promotion of websites using UBE. Does anybody want me to read it out? I'll just shut up for a moment while people look at it. The next one is much the same thing about promotion of UBE tools and millions of CDs and that sort of stuff. And it says you must not offer or distribute things. So I'm just going to shut up and let you. case? Have we seen enough? And what happens next is, does anybody, on the assumption, in the pious hope, I suppose I should really say, that that this is a fair representation of the significant changes, can we? I'm sorry, we can't sort of, you know, we can't just do it here and now. If I try and draft some changes to Right 206 or a new document based on Right 206 that incorporates stuff that is essentially that, you don't have to answer this now. I'm looking to be able to say that that is the view of this working group on this occasion. So that's why I offer this text. You're going to comment on it?
Yes, just to clarify slightly. By the way, for those who don't know me, I'm Malcolm Hutty from Lynx, and I was one of the two principal editors for the changes to the Lynx BCP.
You are welcome, of course, to give a longer talk on it. I hope I've done
that. Well, thank you. I just wanted to clarify, for the sake of those who aren't enormously familiar with these documents, these AUP clauses that we have here are part of an appendix to the BCP, really. That is an informative appendix. The changes within the BCP that are the relevant changes are additional normative statements that you should prohibit the use of, for example, web hosting space for the promotion of for the sale of products that are promoted by spam and so forth. If you go to section...
This is the old version.
That's the old one. Yes, if you bring up the Lynx website...
copy, but that'll do.
Right. If you go to non-core and in the left-hand menu, in the left-hand, yeah, okay. I think they both go to the same place. Actually, if you click cancel there, that will still work. That's just trying to load the style sheet. And go to the BCPs. Is this a local copy you've got?
It was a local copy.
Okay, I'll see what I'll find that for you in a second. But it's under spam. Gosh, it's not in there. So if you're in the private area now, if you click on the news at the top, it's linked from the side menu. If you click on news in the first,
which news?
Under the Lynx Public Affairs portal.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, if you click there, then it's definitely linked from the left hand side, fairly reasonably far down the left hand side. Yes, best current practice. Yes, at the bottom on solicited bulk email, the bottom link on the left of the page at the moment. There you go.
Have to leave the encrypted page, is that true?
Just do it. Oh, and it's still not the right thing. Oh, look, I'm sorry, this is just turning out to be a complete disaster and an embarrassment, so I'll just explain what's actually happening.
Hang on, this is version 1. What I was going to show people was actually version 2.2.
Right, yes.
Do you want me to go back to that?
Let me just talk to it rather than waste everybody else's time more and look even more foolish. the point that I really wish to make was that there is no statement at all that you should be incorporating that wording within AUPs. That wording is simply a description of the kind of wording that you might wish to include as one particular way of implementing the recommendation. So it's not about something you need to get the lawyers involved with around the AUP side, that yes, these are the particular words you have to do. It's simply saying that there are certain normative requirements in the BCP that you can implement in various different ways. That was all the only point that I really wanted to make there.
But was I roughly right in saying that those are the two sort of substantive areas?
They are the two substantive areas. The other set of changes actually related back to what we were talking about a minute ago, which was actually recommending that people use the right database for recording of abuse contacts. It will become increasingly important, because otherwise those free text fields are going to get further polluted with abuse records. But yes, these two are the potentially the most important ones, and they are essentially that where ISPs are, for example, hosting a website or providing some other service that is benefiting from the use of spam, if deliberately benefiting or condoning benefiting from it in that way should be treated as if that person is who is your customer is a spammer, even though they're not actually using your network to send the spam. That's essentially the point. It's of course up to the ISP to go through the process of determining whether or not that's happening, or whether it's somebody else that's sending the spam and attempting to do an AUP denial service attack on the person or whatever. That's all up to the ISP to determine the facts of the matter. But essentially what it is trying to avoid is the situation where you have a spammer that you are hosting on your network it's essentially running some kind of e-commerce website to sell their products, but your lawyers say, oh no, he hasn't sent any spam through our network, so we can't do anything against him. That's essentially what the problem is attempting to be fixed.
Thank you, Malcolm.
James Blessing from Zen. Yeah, the only other thing that's at all contentious in the updated BCP is to do with making sure that you have a contact that isn't necessarily a web form, that you have an email address you can send emails to, rather than forcing people to use a particular interface.
Yes, which we have discussed several times before. Yeah. And there are some bad boys, particularly in the UK, whom we've named and shamed. Okay, well, clearly, I'm sorry, people are well. I'm not trying to stop anybody talking about this. I'm sorry you haven't sort of got the whole thing in front of you unless you've been typing very fast. What I'd like to do is to, if people generally think this is a sound plan, that we ought to update the ripe advice, ideally we'd like to align it with the links advice, because this helps both communities. That on the face of it, the changes are not offensive, and we should be able to do that, but we can't do it now. So I will actually draft an updated thing that will be a ripe document. It'll almost certainly be identical, because I think the sort of changes have been backfitted there. And I'll put it round to the mailing list, and we'll try and get some consensus on that. Hopefully, we don't actually need to go. If it has to come back to the next right meeting in 6 months' time, then it does. But at least we have an intention made fairly clear before that. Does anybody want to object to that procedure? Or anything else? Does anybody want to talk about the issues in having a BCP document about spam? Or anything else in that sort of area? Fine. Thank you. We are back on the rails in terms of content, but in time we're slipping. Nobody has actually fallen off their chair asleep yet, so I think it's worth carrying on. I haven't got a lot of content to put into the rest of this, so it should be all right. I'm just saying. Done that. Developments in bulk mail. I haven't seen a lot of change. The volume goes up and down a bit nowadays. You know, you see great bursts of things, and then nothing happens. They go away for a few days, and then they come back again. But I don't know what it means. It's still mostly done by bots and Trojans on compromised end-user boxes, so far as I can tell. Most of them on the end of DSL lines or something like that. Right, developments in anti-spam. Lovers of Steve Linford will have known that he's had quite a successful run-in with Savvis. I cannot go through all the details of this because I shall get them wrong and because time doesn't permit, but essentially Savvis had, due to some mergers, have picked up a whole lot of fairly bad guys, and Spam House gave them a very short period of time in which to get rid of them or have the whole of their corporate stuff on the Spam House blacklist. I don't think it's quite so crudely as that, but that was essentially what it, and they said, oh yes, we'll do that. I haven't actually heard they'd done it, which is interesting, but on the whole the press from that was good. If you Google for Steve Linford or for Spam House and Savvis, I think you get those things. You might be entertained to look at anything else in the anti-spam world. apart from the married, the sender ID stuff, which I'll mention in a minute. Okay, we're still here. They're still here. The OECD are trying to sort of do a legislative thing. It's a little bit more abstract, if anything, than the EU's things. I'm sorry, Gordon Lennox is from the European Commission, and he doesn't mind being rude about them. But I don't. He might have liked that comment. He might not. I don't know. Anyway, these guys are doing. They've got some. They put out some reasonably interesting. They're having sort of spam summits, but they seem to be inviting, rather as the European Commission would do, incumbent telcos and people like that, rather than spam house and those sort of folk, or ISPs even, not real ISPs. But I thought that was quite interesting, that website. I don't think there are any wonderful new products. The list hasn't seen a lot of discussion. However, I missed something.
Sorry, what's the TRD for OSD? Because I guess something is missing.
Oh,
.org.
What is it?
.org.
Which one? .org. I'm very sorry. I had to hand type that because something wouldn't copy and paste. I'm very sorry. That was stupid. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that. You can find OECD. You know, Google will find OECD. Finding this bit is quite hard.
Okay.
So, not much happened there. Why didn't that move? Because I didn't press the button properly. In the sort of technology field, some other working groups, DNS working group, have heard some stuff about married. Do you think it's appropriate, Peter, to say anything from your point of view on that?
Do you want to say something about
Do you marriage? Would you like to say something about it?
You want to hear some rants about marriage?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Oh, no. Too late for the show.
You might also be able to remember what PRA is.
PRA is, if I guess, purported responsible address. Okay, the... try it that way. Okay.
Wait, you don't know.
So it's me again. I just gave the... presentation about the married working group in the DNS working group this morning, and I try to concentrate on the DNS issues because a couple of the others I really don't understand, including all this patent stuff. What I did understand is that the latest development in that working group was the thing called sender ID no longer may be called sender ID because someone has a trademark on sender ID. So this is kind of stuff they are dealing with. But to start with, is everybody aware what the married working group really is? The married working group is the multiple attempts to do really interesting things in the DNS. No, that's just kidding. It's the MTA authorization records in the DNS. So the basic idea is to have a some kind of data in the DNS to be queried for when your mail server, your accepting mail server, is asked to accept a certain mail. Like, if my mail server is connected to by another entity and they try to send a mail originating from ripe.net, how one determines where that originates is a completely different question. It's not just the mail from. It's a bit more difficult or involved, say. So if that person or that system tries to send in a mail originating from ripe.net, the idea is, well, we should check whether they are authorized to do so. The first candidates being authorized to send mail originating from ripe.net would be the ripe mail servers. But there may be others. So having a list of, say, names or IP addresses in the DNS that could be checked against would help to, well, judge if that particular peer you have is authorized to inject that mail into your system. That doesn't instantly stop spam, but it would help to link that sender somehow with that domain, and that is what the working group or the proposal is about. So there are
various attempts to actually do this, and the problem is that the current method, or the primarily proposed method, which was called, or is still called PRA, Purported Responsible Address, which is part of the, correct me, caller ID project originating from that little company in Redmond, Washington. That is, say, what the IDF likes to call patent encumbered. There are certain patent claims, and the outcome of that is not too clear. So the working group, after the documents were last called on August 23rd, and the last call was extended to September 10th, the working group somehow decided not to follow down that PRA path, or at least explore the way of alternatives. And one alternative now is the so-called mail from scope. That means that, you know all the fun about standards? There are so many of them that you can choose. And this is what is going to happen with the merit stuff. There will be several scopes you can choose from on the announcement side. So for your domains, you may choose to distribute scopes and lists of addresses of mail servers which are allowed to send mail originating in quotes from your domains. And the other part is what you have to implement, or what you are allowed to implement on your own mail servers. On your mail server, you can then choose from those scopes. Scopes simply are methods to identify the sender from the mail. That could be the envelope from, that can be the sender or from header or resend from, or whatever you like. Or at least whatever they describe in their proposals. There are different scopes. The PRA is somehow patent encumbered, but not the announcement. The implementation in that particular mail server. So you may be able to announce the PRA stuff in your DNS records, while at the same time you probably don't want to use, or you have an implementation that where the implementers choose not to implement that stuff. While you may start and continue publishing PRA information, you may not use it yourselves. If anybody is delivering mail to you, you may rely upon another scope, which is same mail from. The revised set of documents has been out on September 16th, I guess, mid last week. And the timeline at the moment I'm not too sure about, I guess, there will be another round of discussion and maybe another set of documents, another working group last call, and then it's supposed to go to ITF last call, which usually adds another 2 weeks, at least another 2 weeks, to that process. So optimistic guess could be by the end of the year, the documents get approved by the ISG, but I am not on the ISG and I won't do any estimates. It's just, one could do so. There are some alternatives or have been discussed in that working group, like the so-called RMX record, which is clearly similar to this SPF. The RMX simply lists a couple of IP addresses allowed to send in mail from a particular domain. Some contentious issues are there. When I said someone is sending in mail from ripe.net, and I check, are they allowed? If it comes from the ripe.net mail servers, probably that will be okay. But what happens if that mail is delivered from a completely different part of the Internet? The first guess could be this is forgery. Second one could be, I had an account on that system. My mail from the right mailing list is still going there and is being forwarded to me. So the forwarding issue has to be dealt with, and that's not too easy. The proposals actually require that the forwarding entity, the MTA, like SendMail or whatever, introduce into the message a new headers. The headers are not really new. They are resend from and resend da-da-da. But the use of the headers for this particular purpose is new. So that has to be changed. There's an alternative approach. The acronym, I guess, is SRS. I've forgotten what the expansion is. It's sender rewriting scheme, right. So that in the mail from the complete path the mail took to my old system, from the RIPE NCC to my old system back to me, that path would be encoded in the mail from, so that I still could, or not me, but the MTA could still somehow link that mail to the real originator. As I said, that won't stop spam. There are discussions underway. What could happen once you have this link? Because as I said this morning, just knowing that that mail came from Hannibal Lecter doesn't mean that mail does anything good to you. You now just have linked the mail to a certain domain, but that could be a spam house or a spam ISP or bad guy, whatever. So the next step might or might not be some reputation system where you can query, well, I now know this mail originates from foo.something. Tell me about the average legitimacy of mail from foo.something, and then do whatever you like with it, feed it into spam assessing or similar things. So this merit stuff will be a first step, but of course it will not stop spam. And, well, we really wouldn't like that. Okay.
Thank you.
That's it.
Thank you, Peter. Anybody want to...
Even at 6 o'clock, want to ask about that? I thought not. That URL is a page of their current internet drafts, and the ones with the 16th of September on are the ones Peter was talking about.
I don't think anything much to cover here. I've mentioned the only thing left here, we've sort of talked about this stuff, is the ASRG down the bottom. The ASRG is the research group from which Married came. Married is an IETF working group, and so they have a finite time frame to deliver, you know, a few things, and they're being pressed fairly hard, I think, to deliver them. The ASRG has a much longer time scale and is worrying about all sorts of other exciting things. Some of it's good stuff, most of it, I'm sure we talked about that. Wilfried of the database working group, but also